This is Phil Perrin, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today, and it's a beautiful day outside, but unfortunately, I can't roll down the windows, so I am going to at least turn on the air a little bit to where at least it's giving me some air from outside. I suppose I could turn on the air conditioning, but it's not really that warm. It's just I'm sitting in front of a car, in a car that has been sitting outside all day. So obviously, it's a little warm. It's been a good week. Got a lot accomplished this week. Not quite as far along as I would like to be with the major project that I'm working on, but things have been going well. We've been able to get some things accomplished that they haven't been able to do functionally before, or haven't taken the time to do functionally before. And so what I'm working on now is able to actually be used in other areas, and so that'll be good to open up those other areas. It's always nice to add enterprise functionality as opposed to just individual department functionality, because then it pays the enterprise in the long run. So that's all going well. Kind of big news with the improv stuff. Coming up this Monday is our final class and then our performance, and then we get our certificates. And my daughter had gotten an email from the teacher, and so to the effect, hey, I was talking to Jeff, who's the founder, And there might be an opportunity that I'd like to discuss with you. So, of course, we were buzzing. What could it be? What could it be? And so one of the things that we discussed as a possibility actually turned out to be what it is. And that is, there seems to be a whole lot more men involved in the improv here than there are women. But the women do have their own show that they've put together called Betty and the Baldwin. And there's just one guy who's the MC, and then there's six women in this show. And normally this show is once a month on like a Saturday night. They get one of the Saturday night slots and they do this show. So I've never been to see it. I've always thought, oh, I gotta go see that show. But it's on Saturday night at 10 o'clock, and so I've never been to see it. Well, as it turns out, one of the ladies who is in that show is leaving. And I think I can talk about this. I don't think there's a problem. And Amber, our teacher, has actually asked Liz if she would like to be in the show. So my daughter has gone from little leagues in improv to being asked up to the AAA teams. As it also turns out, Betty and the Baldwin is doing a show tonight at 7:30. They normally don't do that, but their show this month had to be moved for whatever reason. And so because of that, they're doing a show at 7:30 tonight. And so I'm going over to pick up my daughter here in just a few minutes. It's 5 o'clock now, so I'm going to do the podcast. Gonna run home, get it uploaded, do some high-intensity interval training, and then grab a shower, get something to eat, and then head back in. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see. Lizzie wanted to see the show first before she said yes, because it's a little bit of a different improv show, but Lizzie's gonna do fine. She's gonna do great. And two of the ladies who were in this show are actually main stage ladies. So they're actually major leaguers. One of them is named Sarah Jenkins, who is really, really good. And the other one is Amber, who's our teacher, who is good as well. And so it's going to be interesting to watch them, plus, you know, four other ladies do whatever the Betty and the Baldwin show is. So that should be fun. I have been considering all week whether or not I'm going to move on to level 2. And I had planned to base that pretty heavily on whether or not my daughter was moving on. Because if it's time to spend with my daughter, that is yes. So, pretty much without question, that is yes. But as we talked after Monday night, after she had been asked and she was thinking about it, I asked her, you know, so what are you thinking about level two? Because we're supposed to give an answer before Monday at noon on the level two stuff. And Lizzie said, well, she said, the only thing is if I do Betty and the Bald One, she said, I'm not going to be able to do level two. There's not enough time. And I said, okay, I understand that. I said, well, I'll just make my decision based on myself solely and not worry about whether or not you're going to do that or not. I'll just move forward and make a decision on that. And unless something drastically changes at this point, I am probably not going on to level two. And it has nothing to do with the fact that I don't enjoy it, that it wasn't fun, that I didn't like the people I'm in class with, that I didn't enjoy the teachers, nothing to do with any of that. It really just comes down to time. And it really comes down to an understanding of what it takes to be professionally and technically proficient at something. I don't really just like to do things halfway. I really like to be proficient at what I do. And I've had the opportunity to actually become proficient both technically and professionally in three different areas of my life. Started out life as a musician, have a college degree in music, went on to work as a music editor. So certainly I had become proficient technically and professionally in that field. And that took time. It took years and years. Went from that to being a programmer. Certainly became professionally and technically proficient in that field. Still am. As a computer consultant, I know how much time that took. It took years. At the same time, I was working, after I left music and music notation, then I got into writing and certainly became professionally and technically proficient at that because I was employed for 5 years. Well, I made my living for 5 years as a writer. And I know how long that took. That took years. And so I realized that if I'm going to go on and do improv, that it either has to be completely a hobby, which I don't really have time for right now because I'm working and then my hobby, i.e. my passion, is writing. Or it has to have some future in terms of being professionally proficient. And I understand that that would take years. From everything I can see so far, I think I could get to the place where I could excel at that, at improv. It's a really, really fascinating thing. The way I describe it now is that it's like this magic box that you and a friend climb in this magic box and anything can happen. And that is very cool. And it's a lot of fun. But it's really fun as a hobby. It's really fun as a sideline. It's really fun as a distraction. And at this point, I don't need no more distractions. I have plenty of distractions as it is. So because it would take time away from my writing, and it's not something I would do with Liz if she does Betty and the Bald One and she doesn't go on to level two, it's really hard to justify it. So we're waiting to wrap up Betty and the Baldwin, see how that's going to go. If Lizzie doesn't take the opportunity, I think she's crazy. And my daughter is not crazy. So I just don't see any way she's not going to take it unless we go to the show tonight and it's like, you know. But I don't imagine it will be that, because I know at least two of these performers that are in this. Well, three, actually. I know of them, let's put it that way. And they're very good. Very good. So it should be fine. So that's news there. As far as the writing goes, it's going well. I've been thinking for about 3 days. I'm actually in the flogging scene with Jesus, and I've been thinking, where does that fit in the whole scope of the book and the emotional pacing of the book? Certainly, the Passion of the Christ really exploited that and pushed it, and it was very powerful. But this book that I'm writing is not really necessarily about that, so much as it is about something else that I am conjecturing Jesus did on the cross. So I've been tossing some things around in my head, and I think I have at least a place to get started writing. And then as I write, it'll develop out from there. So have the flogging, and then the initial part of the crucifixion from 9 a.m. to noon, and then the darkness falls, and then we do the darkness. And that is, you know, the big scene in the book. So this should be fun. I'm hoping to get through the crucifixion by this. Just a second. This is my wife. One moment. Hi, sweetie. Uh-oh. Oh, uh-huh. Oh. Well, they called, or somebody called, and said that his EKG looked fine. So, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Who knows? Yeah. Right, right. Ah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Uh-huh. Right. Well, that's usually the way it goes. So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Love you. Bye. Sorry about that. I usually hear, I will turn off the sound on my phone. My dad, the only reason I answered that is my dad had gone in for a dental appointment today, and then I got a call from someone saying, yeah, his EKG was fine, and I'm thinking, what? Well, as it turns out, when he was in the dental chair, he was having some chest pains, and so we're kind of at that time of life where need to be a little more attentive of some phone calls, because you never know what the phone call may bring. Anyways, the writing is going well. I'm not going to have much time to talk about what I want to talk about today, which is The Social Animal, the book. I have to say right off the bat that I was disappointed in this book. It had so much promise. I'd mentioned it before, how cool of a book this was. You know, because the author literally, this is how he starts off the book. This is the happiest story you've ever read. It's about two people who led wonderfully fulfilling lives. They had engrossing careers. earned the respect of their friends, and made important contributions to their neighborhood, their country, and their world. Okay, that's the way he starts it off. I'm thinking, woohoo! What he didn't say is that they learned to love each other in an amazing capacity, and they were faithful to each other. And they did that all their lives, because that's not the way it turned out. And that's why I started getting discouraged. And then, first of all, there's a lot of good stuff in the book, okay? There is a lot of good stuff in the book. And I'll talk about some of that coming up. But I was expecting this to be, like, you know, examples of the latest scientific inquiries about how we can grow together as individuals, you know, and become interdependent as couples and learn from each other and love each other and all this kind of stuff. And I keep reading the book like, yeah, okay. I understand they're having a few difficulties here, but come on, they're going to turn it around. And they never turned it around. They just kind of had some difficulties and drifted apart. And then eventually they kind of drifted back together. And then the main male protagonist dies. So, oh man, feels like a Filipino book. Anyways, setting that aside, there was lots of interesting bits and pieces in the book. So, okay, you know, we take it for what it is. Lots of interesting bits and pieces. One of the things that he said early on is that the key to a well-lived life was to train the emotions to send the right signals and to be sensitive to their subtle calls. And see, I take that something like that because he over and over and over and over referred to what we would consider to be the unconscious, a subconscious mind, and the method of communication is emotion. And so as these emotions are bubbling up, then that's, or thoughts are, you know, popping up in our brains and they're accompanied by emotions and all those kind of things. That's what's coming up from the unconscious. And he pretty much had concluded that you can't really do anything about that. That's just the unconscious and ta-da, it's going to do what it wants to do. But see, I've never really ascribed to that because people will say, well, there's nothing I can do about my emotions. And I will say, yes, there is. Because emotions are always driven by belief. Any emotion that you have is driven by some kind of belief. And if you'll figure out what that belief is, then you can get a lever against the emotion. And I've talked about that before, and we don't need to go into that because I'm almost home. So whenever he was talking about emotions, I was really replacing that with, okay, what he's really talking about is beliefs. And for him, anything down in the unconscious, subconscious, there's just like, you're never going to figure out where that's coming from. Well, of course, I have my own opinions on that. And I have no idea what's actually going on down in there. But the fact is, the model I have works very, very well. So anyways, he did have some interesting things. Like, he was talking about the mind at one point and how the mind is intensely permeable, that stuff flows in and out, that loops can exist between brains, and that the same thought and feeling can arise in different minds. And I've watched this happen when we're doing improv, and it's really cool when you all kind of get on the same wavelength with the person. And one of the other interesting things they did was talk about laughter, and this was kind of pertinent to improv as well. Because he was saying that if you record conversations and you listen to conversations as people are laughing and then you analyze what's going on, only about 15% of it is actually funny. And the rest of it is people laughing in response to recognizing a social situation or recognizing what the person is talking about. Laughter is really a social glue that says, yes, I'm with you. I understand what you're saying there. I'm getting my mail. Which gives me a great deal of comfort because when we do our little improv thing on Monday night, we ain't necessarily going to be horrifically funny. But as long as we can portray something that is true to life, and then people will laugh because they will recognize it. And so that's pretty interesting. And like I said, all of this stuff is just little stuff that's interesting out of this book. He also said alluded to it in several ways, and I've mentioned this, that the brain is an organ inside the skull, but a mind always exists in networks. And this is one of the thrusts of the book, that for us to grow, for us to be challenged, for us to find our path in life, that we really do need other people around us, that other people make an indispensable contribution. We are social creatures. And once again, I forgot that I am not backing into my garage these days, and so I'm having to turn my car around to get my car going the right direction so that I can pull up in one of the little gravel parking places in my driveway. Anyways, he also talks about some interesting little tidbits, like a telephone only transmits 10% of the human voice, and yet people don't have any trouble at all hearing that 10% and figuring out the emotional state of the person on the other end of the line. And that is pretty interesting. Just some other interesting tidbits. There's research that says that when you're trying to solve a problem, sleep really can't help. He quoted one study where these people were given difficult problems to solve, and some of them were told to work straight through, and others were told to start on it, go to sleep, and then get up and do it. And he said those who had slept for 8 hours between the work sessions were twice as likely to solve the problems as those who worked straight through. And he talked about how you can get up in the first thing in the morning, and how when you get up first thing in the morning, your brain can get to solutions on problems. And I find this a lot. If I'm trying to figure out, okay, where is this scene going to sit emotionally? What's supposed to be happening with it? I will intentionally, the first thing when I wake in the morning, I will intentionally refocus on grumpy old prophets. And I'll find a lot of good stuff, will pop up in my brain during that time. And this is another one of the reasons that I'm probably not going to go, most likely not going to go on to level two, because what I would find myself doing is waking up in the mornings and expending that really precious energy when you're clean and fresh and good in your brain on, oh, I could have done this during improv, or, oh, I could have done that. And that, I don't want to lose that. And he did the standard invocation of the benefits of self-control, saying that, there's no question at this point that IQ is not sufficient to be successful, that you really have to have self-control. He's got a quote that says, people with self-control and self-discipline developed habits and strategies that trigger the unconscious processes that enable them to perceive the world in productive and far-seeing ways. See, when I read that sentence, it's like, right, right. Because if you understand flesh and spirit, and when someone gets mad or you have an encounter that couldn't be, if you understand the mechanisms there and you map the framework of flesh and spirit onto it, you can actually control what's going on down in your unconscious and get it to stop stressing and fretting and fuming about this fact that this person said an unkind word to you. And you can move off that energy and get over back to something that's productive. So, interesting. I think I mentioned this before. One of the interesting things they did was they took two classes. They gave them the same test. And before they took a test, they gave all the students a biography of a famous mathematician to read. But some of the students, they changed the birth date of the mathematician to match the birth date of the student. And they said the people who read that biography and identified with the mathematician because their birth date was on the same date, they actually worked on the problem 65% longer. And he was talking about that to show how influential we can be in each other's lives. And that's a really important point. I'm fond of saying you make disciples every day, whether you want to or not. And if you can be the type of person who's an encourager, who's kind, who's generous, you just have no idea how far that's going to ripple out. So that's really important. Just one little side notes. A music teacher talked about the fact that she would ask her students, "How long do you think you're going to continue to play?" when they started to take lessons. And the ones that did best were the ones who said, "I'm going to play the rest of my life because I love this." You know, the ones who said, "Oh, maybe a couple of years," they didn't practice nearly as hard. And he quoted K. Anders Ericsson of Florida State University, who has demonstrated that top performers spend hours, many more hours, rigorously honing their craft. As Ericsson noted, top performers devote 5 times more hours to become great than the average performers devote to become competent. And it gets back to what I was talking about earlier about proficiency. Proficiency takes time. Anyways, there's a whole lot of other interesting stuff in the book. One is he also talks about trust. How trust is the habitual reciprocity that becomes coated with emotion. It grows when two people begin volleys of communication and cooperation and slowly learn they can rely on each other. But it's not just that. Communities learn that they can trust each other and we can all move forward. He said what's interesting about trust is that people in trusting cultures find it easier to organize and operate large corporations. Trust creates wealth. And of course, trust can come about because people have self-control and have made themselves trustworthy. And he said, if you ask Americans to describe their values, they will give you the most individualistic answers of any nation on the planet. Yet, if you actually watch how Americans behave, you will see they trust on another instinctively and form groups with alacrity. And that's really true. One of the things that he said in this book that really has led to my decision to not pursue improv at this time. If I was working at home as a writer full time, I would do it. No question. It would be a fun diversion. But one of the things that has led to me not to pursue it at this time is that he talked about that school asks students to be good at a range of subjects, but life asks people to find one passion that they will follow forever. And that's really true. And for me, that's writing. And so anything that's going to impinge on that, forget it. Anyways, there's more stuff here, more stuff here, more stuff here, but I need to upload this and this is going long. Again, one of the things that he kept coming back to was that, well, the unconscious, you really can't do much about it. But he did talk about how the unconscious, he said that we sometimes like to think of the level two conscious level, the level two, which is the conscious level, that's what they call it, level two, is like Mr. Spock, and the level one is like Homer Simpson. But he actually indicated that that's not quite the model. And see, if that was going to be the model, then the flesh would be the unconscious and the spirit would be the conscious. But that's not what I believe is the model. I've always believed that the flesh and the spirit are operating at a very deep subconscious level and stuff just bubbles up out of that, and you can recognize which is which and by that make a choice. And he really did talk about this, how that the level two is reason and, you know, it, in his words, attempts to make good decisions and things, but it is buffeted about by the unconscious. My contention would be that we may be buffeted about by the unconscious, but that does not take away our ability to choose. And they did have kind of a cute little quote that, as some people joke, we may not possess free will, but we possess free won't. So we really can stop behaviors, which to me, that's free will. If you can stop a behavior, that's free will. Nothing is forcing you to do it. But a lot of time, people are buffeted by their unconscious and they don't really recognize that they're being buffeted. And so then they just go along with it as opposed to digging in their heels and saying, no, I'm not going to behave that way. As I said, I was a little bit disappointed in the way the couple, the protagonist in the book, developed because I was expecting them to find this wonderful, loving relationship and be faithful to each other. And in fact, at one point, the heroine was unfaithful to her husband. Now, of course, he had ways to justify all that and blah, blah, blah. And she certainly paid a price for it emotionally, internally. But it's interesting to see him sort of explain what's going on. And this is how he explained it. In the weeks after, when she thought about the episode, she became aware that it was really possible to become a stranger to yourself, that you always have to be on the lookout and to find some vantage point from which you can try to observe yourself from the outside. Because that was going to be her defense against this happening again. And that's really all I'm doing when I'm talking about the flesh and the spirit. By objectifying the flesh and making it an entity within me that is seeking my destruction, when that stuff bubbles up from my unconscious, I can look at it and say, is this something from that part of me that is not to be encouraged? It helps me objectify and get outside before I just run with whatever feeling that I've got. So while there was a lot of interesting stuff in the book, and it certainly is an interesting read, I wouldn't say it's the happiest story I've ever read. And I guess maybe that kind of tweaked my expectations to be a little higher than they should have been. But, as I said, lots of interesting stuff, and it's fascinating to watch the social scientists sort of nibble away at the edges of what I consider still to be the best framework to give you a handle on moving moment by moment through life and actually finding something that will invariably lead you to success if you implement it. And that is to understand that there's a war within you that's going on beneath the surface. It is the war between the flesh and the spirit, and you have the ability to choose every moment of every day whether or not you're going to listen to the flesh and follow it, or whether or not you're going to listen to the spirit and follow it. And in fact, I found things in this book in terms of his discussions about the level one and the level two in our brains that really fit very well with that model. So that was interesting. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.